This is certainly one of the most brilliant and beautiful objects in the heavens. Under favorable circumstances, the field of view glows and sparkles with innumerable diamonds on a ground dark and rich as the blackest velvet. You are listening to Western Worlds. Welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, 689 miles, as the crow flies, from the Kimberlite of the People of the Parting of the Rocks in London, Ontario, Canada. The imagery used in our opening quote by Elijah Burritt in 1849 to describe the double cluster has been applied to observations of celestial bodies ever since. However, little did we suspect that simple changes in the abundances of certain elements at the start of solar system formation could create worlds where diamond and other carbon compounds could be major planetary building blocks. You see, all the elements that go into forming planets are created in stellar furnaces in a process that we call nucleosynthesis. As the elements get heavier, they become harder and harder to produce, and are therefore less abundant. But two of the lightest and most abundant of these rock-forming elements are carbon and oxygen. In astronomical terms, nucleosynthesis should produce comparable amounts of each, depending on the specific circumstances of the star in question. In our solar system, we have an overabundance of oxygen, and during the formation of the planets, this oxygen preferentially bonded with hydrogen, silica, and iron to produce the solid matter that became the rocky and icy worlds explored by our spacecraft today. But that carbon-oxygen ratio could have gone the other way in other solar systems, leading to exotic landscapes and vastly different geologies. To tell us a little bit about his discovery of an extrasolar planet rich in carbon and about the atmospheres of extrasolar planets in general is Dr. Niku Madison, a researcher from Yale University and our guest tonight. It is remarkable how much can be discerned about such distant places, but the character of the worlds we are discovering is more varied than we ever imagined. Accompanying us tonight is the composition Elemental by Opus 3. Enjoy the interview by David Kirsch.
Welcome to Western Worlds.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start off by getting an overview of how we detect extrasolar planets, and then we'll talk a little bit more about their atmospheres. For starters, how about you tell us how we detect extrasolar planets?
There has been major progress over the last decade and a half in detecting extrasolar planets, and these detections come in particular ways. The most successful of these detection methods has by far been the radial velocity method. In this method, we are detecting the motions of the star caused by the gravitational pull from the planet. So what happens is when the planet goes around the star, the gravitational force due to the planet causes the star to wobble around the center of mass of the system, and by that you can detect those motions by observing the radial velocities of the star along the line of sight from the observer. By detecting those radial velocities, one can place a limit on the minimum mass of the planet. So that's one method that's, you know, you can get the planet mass like that. There is another method which has also been very successful, and that's called the transit method. In this, basically, if you're looking at a star and the planet is crossing the line of sight as it is transiting in front of the star, thereby eclipsing the star for a little while, one can see a small dip in the light from the star. And that small reduction in flux is detectable with current instruments and gives an estimate of the radius of the planet. So these are the two detection methods that have been the most successful to date. And there are other methods that have also been fairly successful, one of which is the direct detection technique, which means if the planet and the star are widely separated, you can actually detect both of them. You can tease out the light from the planet itself by blocking the star. So in that case, one can get an entire spectrum of the planet.
So that method is the most like taking a direct picture of star and its planets.
Exactly. And then there are other methods like the gravitational microlensing and pulsar timings and so on and so forth. But the radial velocity and transit techniques have been the most successful to date.
Okay. And in particular, the Kepler mission has given us something like 2,000 planets now detected by the transit method.
Exactly. Planet candidates. Yeah. So the Kepler method works based on the transit technique, and it has given us about 2,000 candidate planets.
So you mostly work on extrasolar planet atmospheres.
Right.
And this is in particular really cool because we're not just looking at a simple number like the mass of the planet or the size of the planet. We're actually trying to characterize planets' atmospheres. Tell us a little bit about how you do that.
If you're talking about the transiting planet method, what happens is when the planet is going in front of the star, it's crossing the line of sight from the observer to the star. In transit, part of the starlight is passing through the atmosphere of the planet, right? So we are seeing essentially the limb of the planet and starlight passing through that limb and reaching the observer. There will be absorption features in the starlight that are imprinted due to the atmosphere of the planet, which means molecules in the planet's atmosphere have absorbed some part of the starlight at some wavelengths. By detecting those features, one can in principle infer what the chemical composition and temperature structure of the planet's atmosphere is at the limb of the planet. A complementary effect to that is that when the planet is just before disappearing behind its star, which is a situation which we call secondary eclipse, which means just half a period after the planet has transited the star will transit the planet, or the planet is hiding behind the star in eclipse. That's a secondary eclipse. And just before the planet is about to disappear, one is seeing the entire day side of the planet. So then, if we can measure the total flux from the system, we're seeing the flux from the star, or light from the star, and we're seeing light from the planet's day side. And then, a moment later, the planet actually disappears behind the star, then we're seeing just the flux or the light from the star. Now, if you subtract those two, we are getting just the light from the planet. That way, one can get the light from the planet at several different wavelengths, and that is what one calls a spectrum. And if we can get a spectrum of the entire dayside atmosphere of the planet, we can also infer its molecular composition and temperature structure.
Okay, and I imagine that subtraction is fairly hard to do, requires a good signal.
Right, that is very hard to do. It requires of the order of a part in 10,000 precision on the light measured from the star.
Now, this is done with transiting planets, and if Kepler has given us something like 2,000, how many of those would this method actually work for?
In principle, if we have the best of instrumentations, this method should work for all of them, because that's exactly what the transiting geometry does. However, currently existing instruments are not as capable on Kepler targets, because the stars are, a lot of them are faint for current instruments. But in the future, with instruments on the James Webb Space Telescope, we should be able to follow up the planets.
And when is the James Webb Space Telescope coming online?
It is scheduled for flight towards the end of the decade, around 2018.
So by that point, Kepler's mission should be pretty much wrapped up.
Right.
Or at least beyond its original scope.
Right.
So we should have thousands of planets, and we'll be in a pretty good position to start measuring as many atmospheres as we would like, I guess.
Right. But there are other, besides Kepler, there are hundreds of planets that have been discovered just by ground-based surveys. And we can follow up a lot of those planets and their atmospheres with current instruments. And we have had major successes doing that.
All right. So this method has a lot of potential.
Yeah.
And so now let's talk about what it's already discovered so far, I guess. What have we learned?
Yep. So over the past decade, we are at a very exciting phase in exoplanetary science, because over the past few years, we have just moved from detection, planet detection, to what we call as planet characterization, which means understanding the atmospheres and interiors of these planets in detail. In the last 15 years, there has been, as I mentioned, a lot of progress on the planet detection. And they have given us hundreds of transiting planets, which are good candidates for these atmospheric studies. Now, over the past 5 years or so, we have made major progress in trying to understand their atmospheres, in particular of these transiting planets. And there are several results that have come out of this major effort, some of which are, first, we have had a lot of atomic and molecular detections in these atmospheres. We have measured absorption from sodium and potassium, absorption from molecular species like water vapor, methane, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and so forth. And we have also measured stratospheres. We call them thermal inversions in the scientific jargon. What they are basically like the stratosphere on Earth. You know, if you look at the temperature structure of the Earth, as you go up in altitude, the temperature reverses. So until a certain altitude, the temperature is decreasing, and then suddenly the temperature starts increasing. And that's because of strong optical absorption due to ozone in the stratosphere. We find similar stratospheres in the atmospheres of giant planets around other stars. These are called hot Jupiters. And there we don't know yet what the stratospheres are being caused due to, but we have claims of detection of the stratospheres. So as you can see, there is a wide range of detections that have been made from a characterization standpoint. And one of the more recent, which is in the last year or two, more recent results that have come out of such efforts has been the measurement of elemental abundance ratios, like the carbon to oxygen ratio or carbon to hydrogen, oxygen to hydrogen ratios. And those are very crucial because from the elemental abundance ratios, one can in principle put constraints on how the planets were formed and what their interiors could be made of and so forth. So that is the sort of exciting phase that we are in, is that we are being able to, for the first time, get these detailed constraints on their elemental compositions. And I think in the next decade or so, this is going to be a major frontier in exoplanetary science.
So we can learn not just that the planet is there, but also what's in its atmosphere, what is its atmosphere like, and even beyond that, how the planet was formed, and even stuff about its interior.
Right.
So that's extremely exciting stuff. That's basically all there is to know about the planet. So in particular, your research focuses on carbon-rich planets. How about you tell us, what is a carbon-rich planet?
One major part of my research recently has been measuring these carbon-to-oxygen ratios. And in early 2011, which was last year, we attempted to measure the carbon to oxygen ratio in a giant planet atmosphere around another star. This planet is called WASP-12b. It's a very hot planet, and if you make some models of how the atmosphere of this planet should look like, you expect that it should have a lot of water vapor in its atmosphere. If the carbon to oxygen ratio is close to 0.5, which is what we know for the Sun and which we know is true for the host star of the planet itself.
Is that true for the Earth and the other solar system planets then?
Yes. I mean, we don't know for Jupiter what the carbon to oxygen ratio is for other reasons that I can go into. But generally speaking, for most solar system bodies, we know that they're oxygen rich. For Earth, the carbon to oxygen ratio is 1 in 1,000, which means carbon is very underabundant compared to oxygen. That's for a rocky planet. But if you have a giant planet around a sun-like star, you expect its atmospheric composition to be close to the stellar composition based on previously existing theories. Those theories are being changed now, but we can talk about that. So we expected that WASP-12b's atmosphere should also have a carbon-to-oxygen ratio of close to 0.5 because its star had such a ratio. And if you had such a ratio of 0.5, you would expect a lot of water vapor in its atmosphere because it's inherently oxygen-rich. Now we measured the C2O ratio in this planet, and to our utter surprise, what we found was there was more than 100 times less water than we expected. That means less than 1% of the water we expected is what is actually there. So what that immediately translates to, the only way that can happen is if you had a carbon to oxygen ratio greater than 1, but nowhere close to 0.5. And by measuring constraints on other species like carbon monoxide, methane, and so forth, we could constrain the carbon to oxygen ratio to greater than or equal to 1. To very high statistical confidence. So that sort of started this area of carbon-rich atmospheres that are observable with current instruments.
Why are these atmospheres strange? Why are they not what we expected?
These atmospheres are strange because of one reason, which I already mentioned, is that there is very little water vapor in this atmosphere. And that contradicts most of what we have known so far about planetary atmospheres. We inherently expected planetary atmospheres everywhere to be oxygen-dominated. There have been a few studies in the past which have suggested that carbon-rich planets could exist, C2O ratios could be different, and so on. There have been theoretical studies for a long time now, but a few of them. But only for the first time is we are seeing slight evidence that might in fact be true. And if that is true, it changes a lot about our understanding of planetary interiors and planet formation.
So what does this tell us about planet formation then? How does it change the models?
You know, in the prevalent theory of Jupiter, for example, it's the core accretion theory. You accrete planetesimals to make a core, and then you have runaway accretion of a lot of gas and more planetesimals to make a giant planet.
Like a snowball running downhill, it's just something that starts small and grows bigger and bigger.
Right. If you have that scenario in an oxygen-rich environment, most of the planetesimals would have water ice in them. That's just what chemistry would predict. If you form condensates in an oxygen-rich environment, you make condensates with a lot of water ice in them.
So like comets then.
Right. But that scenario would not explain a high carbon to oxygen ratio because you're adding more planetesimals with water ice, so you'll add more oxygen. So that can't happen. So there should be an alternative way to make carbon-rich giant planets like WASP-12b that I've been talking about. And there are a couple of ways that could happen. One way is if there is a variation in the carbon to oxygen ratio in the disk where the planet was formed. So far we have just been assuming that giant planets form in regions which have this carbon to oxygen ratios similar to the ratios of the star. But what if there are fluctuations in the chemical distributions in the disk and that there could be a local carbon to oxygen ratio at the region where the planet formed that's not necessarily representative of the stellar C2O ratio but somewhat higher. And that could be due to several processes which remove water ice early on, even before the planet formed, or by some other process, and that contributes to an effectively high C2O ratio. And then if you make a planet in that environment, you end up with a carbon-rich planet.
So now we're not just learning about the planets, we're even learning about the environment in which planets formed.
Right.
And presumably this can be extrapolated out to the formation methods of all planets.
And there are other scenarios, like you could also put constraints on where the planet is actually formed in the disk, because if you have a disk around the star and there are planets being formed in the disk, as you go out away from the star, the temperature in the disk is changing. And the farther you go, the cooler it gets, and you are condensing various species before you get to far out regions in the disk. For example, you would have condensed most of the water ice in the disk by the time you get to very distant regions of the disk. And there you could have a gas from which all the water has been removed already due to condensation, and you're left with an effectively carbon-rich gas in the disk. And if you made planets purely out of such gas, you can end up with a high C2O ratio in the planet.
Now, I saw an article that mentioned that planets like this might have diamond mountains in their cores, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything to that? Diamonds in these planets?
For a giant planet like WASP-12b, there won't be any mountains. The cores are at extremely high pressures, and we don't even know what exact phase the diamond would be in. That's assuming that the rocks at the core are carbon-rich, not just the gas. So that's an extrapolation that we're not sure of. But if you formed rocky planets in similar environments, it's just obvious what the surfaces would look like, and they could, rocky carbon-rich planets, could have mountains of diamonds on them. And in fact, diamonds would be extremely abundant, and silica, like sand we know on Earth, would be extremely rare on such planets. So it's not a complete fiction. It's a very plausible scenario that if you had rocky planets forming in carbon-rich environments, they could be very abundant in graphite and diamond and other carbon-based rocks, and very underabundant in silica-based material.
Sounds like a very alien world indeed. Now, what would this mean for life on worlds like that?
We'll have to rethink our notions about life. Most of the time when we're looking for extraterrestrial life, we would like to presume that such a life would require oxygen. And
that it would look like us.
And would look like us. Or we make the assumption that such a life would require water, like other compounds that we sustain. But on carbon-rich planets, all those notions have to be changed. There may not be enough oxygen. There may not be enough water for life like us to exist. But that doesn't mean that life won't exist. It's just that whatever life exists should adapt to such circumstances, and we have to keep our minds open to such possibilities.
When we look at extrasolar atmospheres, presumably one of the things that we're looking for is signs of life or other qualities that might sort of lead us in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the specific sort of things that we're going to look for if we're looking for extraterrestrial life?
The short answer to that is that we don't know. But we have to start from somewhere. And the best place we can start from is our own Earth. When we go for extraterrestrial searches for life, we start with biosignatures on our own planet. And those could be common signatures like oxygen, O2, ozone, methane, and sources like these.
And these are compounds that we have already actually discovered on other planets.
Actually, not on other planets. These are the molecules that we know are present on Earth. So these are the molecules that we'll be looking for in exoplanet atmospheres, small rocky exoplanet atmospheres. But we are far from detecting them.
But we found like water and methane.
Right. But the molecules we found are in giant planet atmospheres, big gassy Jupiter-like planets, very hot planets is where we have already found all these molecules in gas phase. But what we are looking for are small rocky planets with atmospheres with these molecules like oxygen, water vapor, ozone, and so on. And we are at least a decade away from such sort of detections. The James Webb Space Telescope in the future should be able to follow up some of the discoveries that we have already made of rocky planets.
Have we detected any compounds on rocky planets then yet?
Not yet.
Okay, so that sort of atmospheric research is still in the future?
That is the new frontier. We have some planets which are intermediate between very rocky planets and Neptune-like planets, and we call them super-Earths. So we have some atmospheric detections of super-Earths, and that's another new frontier. But so far, the only major conclusion we have come up with is that their atmospheres should have a lot of clouds in them. So we have not been able to make a molecular detection yet.
Just sort of blanket observations about how reflective or...
Right, but that's a major area of research right now is how can we extract molecular compositions of these super-Earths and rocky planets
in
the future.
It's still really hard to detect Earth-sized planets at all. We only have a few.
Right.
So the fact that we're now talking about not just detecting them, but detecting their atmospheres, this is also exciting stuff for the future.
Yeah, as I mentioned, this is a frontier, is to detect and characterize all the rocky planet size ranges. And in the next decade or two, this will continue to be a major frontier because new instruments are just being built and are about to come into action in the next decade.
You mentioned that things we would be looking for would be water or methane, other things that might imply life on Earth. So is there any single thing, or what do you think is the most promising thing to look at in an extrasolar atmosphere and say, yeah, there is life on that planet?
It is hard to say at this point. I would love to be more specific, but there is no specific answer to that. We'll just have to keep our minds open and continue to have the surprises we have had so far in exoplanet atmospheres. Of course, if we find a planet in the habitable zone of its star, and by habitable zone, I mean the temperatures are right enough to have liquid water, and if we found atmospheric signatures of water vapor and oxygen, that should be a pretty good sign of having life like we expect.
So basically, if we can find a planet that looks like Earth and has an atmosphere like Earth, that's a pretty good guess?
That's probably a pretty good guess.
Okay, and when do you think that sort of observation will be made?
That specific observation of the atmosphere of an Earth-like planet will take us at least a decade, if not a new generation of instruments beyond a decade.
But it is foreseeable, it is certainly possible?
Yes, it is in the foreseeable future. And if the James Webb Space Telescope comes online as expected, or in the next decade, we should be able to make these measurements for small rocky planets, not necessarily the exact same size like the Earth, maybe slightly bigger planets which are more amenable to observations, but we should make good progress with the James Webb Space Telescope, and then we'll know what the limitations of that generation are so that we can push forward to the next generation of instruments in the next decade or two.
Excellent. So this is really exciting stuff within the foreseeable future. Hopefully we have a chance at spotting extrasolar life?
It's a good possibility, yes.
Excellent. Dr. Manushan, thank you very much for coming out and talking with us here at Western Worlds.
Thank you very much for having me here.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So it's interesting again to be talking about exoplanets. It's certainly an area of broad current interest. And it's interesting to hear once again about the variety of techniques that we have for detecting them, but also about the variety of things that we're finding.
You know, and what I find interesting about that is he was talking about how he was researching carbon-rich planets. You think about 5-10 years ago, there wasn't these, you know, very specific areas of research in exoplanets. I mean, exoplanets was a specific area of research, but now we have people that are studying the atmospheres of these planets and all these different techniques. And so I think it's amazing how far it's really come in just such a short amount of time.
Yeah, you used to win the big prize for finding one. Just detecting one was a big deal. And
right.
Now, you know, you have people who are in the different departments of the exoplanet section. And I think it's interesting as well that we're starting to use this large set of exoplanets that we have as a way of interrogating all the different possibilities, not only of how planets can be, but also of how they can form, and to try and constrain our models and maybe reimagine our models of planet formation.
Yeah, it's definitely expanding on the one data point that we've had for the last however many hundreds of years, seeing these planets that are orbiting around pulsars and these ones with crazy orbits and these really hot Jupiters that are, you know, within the orbit of Mercury, if it was in our solar system. I mean, it's pretty intense, just the amount and the huge range of planets that we have.
Most of which we never would have predicted. Hot Jupiters in particular, I remember the controversy. Some people just refused to believe the discovery of the first one because it was so bizarre. There was absolutely no way it could have formed. No way it could be there. So therefore, you must be wrong. And then, you know, now we have 100 or several hundred of them discovered. Or, well, several hundred Kepler candidates, I should say, which are not official discoveries until confirmed.
But. Right. So there are 61 Kepler confirmed planets and, yeah, like 2,300 some that are candidates. And then there are, by other techniques, such as radial velocity and microlensing and stuff, there are about 760 some, I think.
Yeah.
Confirmed,
yeah,
planets.
Confirmed,
I mean,
planets.
That's,
yeah,
incredible.
That's a lot.
I remember doing outreach even 2 years ago when I would say, oh, we have, you know, 200 planets, and it was so exciting, and now I'm just...
Yeah, I remember when I was first year in Adelgra, I was just hearing about exoplanet. And by the time in my fifth year, I was actually doing a senior astronomy project in detecting exoplanet with our university telescope.
Cool. So what kind of technique were you using?
We just used a transit method.
Okay.
And it was in the city, too. So it's not just professional astronomers that can do this kind of science these days. Even an amateur with the right equipment and the right, you know, at the right place, they can also conduct this kind of experiment.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Did you find anything?
Oh, it was tiny, though.
Yeah.
Well, it was really cool to see the dip in the light curve.
Of course, we have a large number of these confirmed planets, and all, I guess, of the Kepler candidates are detected by the transit method. But this only works where the plane of the solar system that we're observing is aligned with the line of sight from us to that star.
Right. So it's actually pretty incredible that there are that many planets.
Yeah,
because they're in random directions, right?
Yeah, they're all going to be in different orientations, and the great majority of them will not be lined up with us.
Yeah. You have to be lined up. It's a very small. I mean, the angular diameter of a star across the sky is not degrees. It's milli arc seconds. It's thousandth of a 60th of a degree. So if you're tilted just by that much up above or down below the star, no transit, and we don't see it. So that really argues that the galaxy is just crawling with planets.
Yeah, and it's still a matter of sort of wild speculation how many that is. We're starting to constrain that, but making estimates about how many planets and what the makeup in terms of the types would be, this is still very unknown.
Yeah, we definitely have a lot to learn, and hopefully with all of these hundreds of new planets, we'll be able to come up with some rigorous models of planetology or planet formation that we'll be able to finally explain what the heck is going on.
Yeah, although I suspect before we come up with those rigorous models, we're going to come up with a whole lot of questions about how all these varied forms of planetary systems could possibly come about.
Well, and that's an interesting thing, right? Because for most of human history, when we've been looking at those planets, it's been our solar system. So we know what our solar system looks like, but we have no idea what it looked like in the past or what it may look like in the future. So when we look at these different types of solar systems, they could give us a key to maybe how our solar system looked and how it formed.
That's right. And, you know, some of the thoughts about how our system formed involve the larger planets, Jupiter and Saturn, migrating into different orbital positions from where they formed to where they finally ended up.
This is the famous Nice model.
Yeah, the Nice model, which, you know, is the latest vogue.
Right.
Google it, folks.
Nice spelled nice, N-I-C-E.
That's right, N-I-C-E. This is the city in France where they're coming up with these planets.
Right.
But in any case, you know, we have this idea of migration, but it's dependent on sort of the gravitational layout of the solar system and sort of the starting parameters. And it's entirely possible that some of these systems start in a similar way. Do they migrate? Does the migration fail? Does, you know, how does that kind of thing evolve and give us systems that work out like ours and systems with big gassy planets right next to the star?
Well, in a lot of these models, I mean, they're a really great starting point, but there's a lot of knobs you can be twiddling, right?
Yes.
You can say if Jupiter goes in and then goes back out, a lot of this is from where the small body populations are now. Mm-hmm. And so they think, okay, how can we get the solar system as it is now by moving stuff around? And so there are really two big theories in solar system formation and evolution of how things got there. Either things are moving around or things got hit by something else. And those are like, you know, the way to explain things.
That is the classic cop-out of planetary science. We don't know what happened,
but impacted. I wouldn't say cop-out, but I would say it's kind of the Occam's razor of planetary science, right? The simplest explanation would be something knocked it over. Like, for example, Uranus. Uranus is tilted over practically on its side, right?
That axial inclination is very high.
Right, yeah. And so that's how we think that happened. But if we can see these other solar systems and see what's going on in there, it might give us it might constrain those models a bit more, and I think that's really the key.
And of course, if you want to understand things like the orientation of planetary rotational axes and the atmospheres and the sort of the details pertaining to specific planets, you have to start looking really finely at the system. And it's interesting to hear describe this process where they're looking at transiting planets and they're able to see the face of the planet just before it disappears behind the star.
Yeah.
And they're able to see the backside of the planet just before it covers up and occludes part of the star.
Right. It's funny because when people think of the transit method, they think of the planet going in front. But there's a lot of information you can get from it going behind the star as well.
Yeah, and so you break the planet's orbit up into these separate periods, and now you have these discrete observations that are all different.
So you're looking at different portions, different angles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you get to see the daytime side of the planet, too, which will give you a lot
that's
more information.
That's actually really interesting, and there's some fun stuff coming out, especially on the hot Jupiters, where the daytime, they're all tidally linked. So the one side always faces the star. You have to be tidally linked for that. You're that big and you're that close. And so we're measuring daytime temperatures hot enough to melt tungsten and nighttime temperatures, which are, you know, cold by human standards. And so the models then you would have to have, since you have a thick atmosphere on a gas planet, these titanic winds carrying the heat around, and it's just turns into very bizarre looking bodies.
Yeah, they're very exotic, these
things. And I read about the storm that, because due to the temperature difference, the storms on those hot Jupiters, they could reach as fast as 7,000 kilometers per hour.
Oh, wow.
Which is very fast.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not sure that our ability to do fluid dynamic modeling is up to the task of this. Yeah, we're going to have these huge temperature differences, huge pressure differences, boundary conditions at the bottom end of the atmosphere that are not very well understood, and at the top of the atmosphere, where the atmosphere will start breaking down into ions and having a changing concentration, and the conservation of mass is not preserved because stuff is probably being blown off the upper atmosphere by the solar winds.
Yeah.
So trying to do a fluid dynamic model of that is going to be very difficult.
But what's cool is that you get to use planetary science techniques to really affect other sciences, right? Like you saying fluid dynamics, thermodynamics might have some effect from this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back to, you know, how we were saying that the hot Jupiters have the hot side and the cold side. I mean, we have that in the sense we have Mercury, but of course that's just a big rock, right? So it's a lot different.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting is, you know, we're talking about at the planet level, but let's talk at the planetary system level, where you're forming star systems. The discussion about carbon-enriched planets. We used to have this idea that everything in the solar system formed from the same solar nebula, so it should all have similar compositions. And now we're finding planets where the expected ratios between the expected simple light elements, light being, you know, the first 10 or 15 elements here, are not what we expected. And we're finding that they're very enriched in one or very depleted in the other. And how do we explain that? Why is there some portion of the planetary nebula that is not following the same concentrations of these elements?
Yeah, and he was kind of talking about, you know, having these sections almost that are depleted in certain elements and how in the world did that happen?
Yeah, this is very speculative so far because we don't actually have these measurements for two planets in one system to say that these ratios are going to be different from one planet to another.
But we have the star, and we have the
star,
gas planet,
yes,
and they're very different.
Right, whereas in our solar system, they're similar.
By and large, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
This is true.
I mean, it's not exact, but basically everything has a solar composition, right?
Yeah, and we know that as you go farther out in the system, you're going to reach things like the so-called snow line, where the water can't maintain a vapor state anymore, and everything outbound of that sees very icy materials. imagining that process happening for all the elements, it still doesn't explain this. So it's interesting that there may be a lot of mixing or turbulence or other processes happening in these pre-stellar nebulae that are really not understood at this point.
And that we actually didn't even think of.
That's right.
Before, until we had these observations, and now it's making us wonder.
Once again, we're just amazed by our own ignorance, I think, at this point. That the universe has, as always, turned out to be far more marvelous and grand than we even conceived of.
Yeah, there was a physicist, I don't remember his name exactly, so I won't venture a guess, but he said something that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. And we keep finding new and strange and bizarre and fascinating things.
And you know what? This is a prime example of why pure science still needs to happen, because there's so much going on that we have no idea about. I mean, people just think, oh, we know everything about the Earth, or we know everything about the Moon or about Mars, but we're constantly finding out about things, not just in our neighborhood, but, you know, in our galaxy and in other galaxies. I mean, it's immense, the stuff we don't know. And I think it's very ignorant for us to say that we do know everything.
Absolutely. 20 years ago, there were no exoplanets, and 10 years ago, there was no water on the Moon. And now the Moon is full of water.
There was no water on the Moon, no water anywhere in the solar system. Yeah,
that's right.
Well, we knew about comets, at least.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
But even that was a novelty. So, no, there's a lot to be learned by looking still at nature. We haven't looked at every place, and we'll learn a lot about this little corner of the universe by looking at the rest of it.
That's our show for this week. Western World is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Dave Kirsch. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Tyler August, Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, and Zengi Hu. Our editors were David Kirsch, Alyssa Gilbert, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online, listen to past episodes, or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.